All right, Alexander, let's talk about the market meltdown, the coronavirus, and just the chaos, the panic, the terrible effects of what's going on with this virus and the oil price war. I mean, what can you say? I mean, I'm on Drudge. I'm reading the headlines right now. You know, Trump to declare a national emergency, complete shutdown of the table. I saw the Justin Trudeau press conference. I know you saw it too. His wife tested positive. He says he's tested negative, but Justin Trudeau said, and I quote, "We're pulling out all the stops." You know, he says he's going to pull out all the stops to fight the spread of the virus in Canada. You know, I'm on Ikathi Merini for Greece. Malls, cafes, bars, eateries to close as coronavirus cases rise to 190. There, it's starting to really take hold in Greece, and they're pretty much putting the whole country on quarantine. In Cyprus as well, where I am right now, it's growing rapidly. And, you know, the president is going to be giving a press conference today, the Cyprus president. And I don't understand why he didn't close the airport. We were talking about this before he did the video. I mean, I just think he should shut the whole thing down because I just don't see what other options you have left. I understand the economic implications. But anyway, Alexander, I'm rambling. You know, things are bad. I don't know what else to say, but things are really, really bad.
Well, you're not rambling, and things are really extremely bad. And to bring back that phrase that we were getting a few years ago so much, so often, it's a perfect storm. I mean, we have a virus raging. This is happening at the same time as an oil price war. And of course, we're having a crash on the markets. Of course, all of these things are connected, but they're all connected in interesting ways. Firstly, we have to be absolutely clear about this. A virus of this nature is going to bring economic activity to a complete stop as governments respond to the health emergency that it is creating. And already you see action being taken by governments in a very confused, muddled and disorganized way in many places. But you talked about how the Cypriot government is reluctant to close down the airport. Here in Britain, the government is still very reluctant to close down schools, for example.
I saw Johnson's press conference, by the way, yesterday as well. Give your thoughts. Sorry.
Well, I thought, frankly, very unimpressive. I mean, he's not got a grip on the situation. At least he wasn't as completely as delusional as our friend Emmanuel Macron was, where he talks absolutely inanely about the fact that, you know, the virus doesn't recognize borders. Well, of course, it doesn't recognize borders or nationalities, but that doesn't mean you don't put in border controls. I mean, that's a total non sequitur. Sorry about the Latin. It's completely illogical. And it shows how ideologically obsessed he is and the extent to which he simply can't stop virtue signaling. In fact, he's so indoctrinated with virtue signaling that it doesn't seem to him to understand that he's doing it anymore. And of course, with Merkel is asleep at the wheel. It's all doom, gloom and disaster in Germany, according to her. The German government says that they're prepared to increase liquidity. But, you know, you can increase liquidity, you can pour out money. But at the end of the day, if people aren't buying, or if people are buying all the wrong things, I mean, shops are running out of critical foodstuffs in London now. My local bakery is out of bread. Dried pasta has essentially vanished. All kinds of food products, fresh fruit is becoming increasingly difficult to find. This is in central London. If there is that kind of economic implosion, then you can print money and you can increase liquidity as much as you like, but it's not going to help the economy and it's not going to help the markets. Now, the markets, as lots of people have been telling us for a long time, people like Mitch Feinstein, whom I slightly know, people like Peter Schiff, people like Max Kaiser, all these sort of people, they've been telling us for a very long time. Tom Luongo is another person who, you know, we speak about often. Mike Whitney, who, often writes about these matters. They've all been telling us for a very, very long time how massively overextended markets are, how this policy of QE, of quantitative easing, has far from fixing the problems that started with the financial crisis of 2008, that they made it, it's made it worse, that, we've had overvalued stocks, we've had overvalued equities, we've had problems in the bond markets, all of those things. But it's important, again, to say that if you have a economy that is grinding to a stop anyway, because people are not going to go to factories and people are not going to go, buy goods, and because air traffic is starting to seize up and all of those things. Of course, financial markets are going to seize up, and they would even if the financial system was in the best of health. I am not saying it is in the best of health. All I'm saying is, people have to be realistic about these things. And the same applies to the oil price war. Now, we've done some very, very good programs about NBS and how wildly and irrationally he is acting, and how it's absolutely crazy for him to start, producing oil, increasing oil supplies by 4 million barrels a day at a time when demand is collapsing. But given that demand is collapsing, we need to understand that the oil price would be falling anyway. And I saw a Russian official who just made exactly that point. He said, it's all very well about people can talk about the fact that OPEC Plus has just fallen apart, but we would be at the position we now are in with oil prices at $30 to $35 oil. Anyway, even if a production cut had been agreed, because production cuts cannot keep up with the pace of collapsing demand. So, MBS turning on the taps is going to make a bad situation worse, but the situation is very bad anyway. And that's the reality. And I have to say straight away that I think that governments around the world have not grasped how serious the situation is. And I think far too many of them have been anxious to try and keep the economies moving and to preserve economic activity and economic stability, when what they really need to understand is that they're dealing with a massive, existentially scaled public health crisis. And until and unless that is overcome, we're not going to see economic activity return, not in any sensible or proper way. So that is the real crisis at the moment. We can worry about what's going on in the markets. We should worry about what's going on in the markets. We should worry about the oil price. But ultimately, it is the coronavirus that is the urgent priority at the moment.
Everyone thought that the markets would collapse due to some sort of war or larger proxy war, NATO versus Russia or NATO versus China, something like that, or maybe some terrorist incident, another 9/11 type of thing. But at the end of the day, is it going to be the virus that brings everything to a halt, that collapses the system? Because I've been watching videos and reading, from all the people that you were talking about, like Peter Schiff and all these guys and Tom Lungo and everyone, and that they've called the economic situation correctly as to how over-leveraged everything is, from businesses to banks. And we've been waiting for this large collapse. Yeah. Everyone's, waiting for this large collapse to occur. Mm. And everyone has a lot of theories as to when and how, but no one ever expected a virus to take such a drastic toll on the markets. Is the virus the big one?
Well, possibly, very likely it is. I mean, I think the point to make, first of all, is that, of course, if we go back to December, nobody was expecting it then. Nobody was talking about, a virus epidemic sweeping the world in 2020. All sorts of countries had all kinds of plans. China had its Belt and Road. Russia had its national development plan. Boris Johnson's government in London was looking at, you know, its plans for Brexit. All kinds of governments had plans. Nobody had expected that the thing that would cause everything to fall apart would be a virus, But you're quite right. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion for a lot of people, a lot of very well-informed people, saying for a very long time that there are fundamental underlying problems in the markets. And I think, as you also rightly say, that analysis is being vindicated. But it's only, you know, it was the virus. It might have been something else. It might have been a war. It might have been a problem with one particular bank. It might have been any number of what are now called black swan events. It just happened to be this one. Now, I think this is an important point to stress, I am a perennial optimist. Counsels of despair are never useful. I think we will get over this one. In fact, I am absolutely 100% sure we will. I think we will eventually surmount this health crisis too. I think, you know, coming at the other end, out at the other side of it, we will see economies recover and we will see markets recover. But it may not be the same as it was before, because I expect that what the virus is going to do is it is going to expose the many problems that are there within the financial system. And perhaps realistically, that's a good thing, because of course, if we have these problems out in the open, we can purge them and get rid of them and sort them out, as arguably we failed to do after the 2008 crisis.
Pat Buchanan wrote an article today asking the question if the virus is the end of the New World Order and the neoliberal order and the open borders ideology and all that stuff. Do you agree with that? That the virus may be that tipping point to end all this nonsense, this New World Order, neoliberal, open borders nonsense once and for all?
Well, I'm going to say straightforwardly that I think so, but I also hope so, because the way this virus has spread and the weakness of governmental responses to it and the massive problems we are seeing in the financial system and the world economy are a direct product of that new world order. It's because markets are so interconnected and are so global and have become so grossly leveraged and financialized that there are problems in the markets. It is because states and sovereign states have been weakened so much that they're struggling to respond properly to a health crisis such as this is, and why they've managed to lose control of market regulations. Why, you know, if as is often said, if the British government wanted to regulate the City of London, it wouldn't be able to, because this is now a global market and governments don't really have the control that they once did. They've ceded that control. They've ceded their control to the markets. They've lost control of their borders. They've lost control of their health policies. And hopefully, we are going to see the end of this. If we don't actually learn from this lesson, we're going to see even more problems on an even bigger scale down the line. It's inevitable, because no single government can control this thing.
Yeah, I'm looking at the progression of the virus, Alexander. You look at China and Italy, and now it's happening in Spain, UK, and just sweeping across Europe and the US as well. China is now ramping up again. At least those are the reports coming out. Whether you believe them or not, it's a whole different video. But they are saying that, you know, things are starting to ramp up again. I think today was the first case where they counted only double-digit cases. Yes. Eight, five.
Yes.
Coronavirus positive cases, and so even Wuhan, they say, is starting to get back on its feet, and they're starting to lift restrictions. And then you look at Italy, where they say Italy now is at its peak. And that bell curve will start to go down slowly, slowly. And it looks like Europe now is just about to hit that bell curve and it's going to ramp up. So, you know, people in the UK can kind of look at Italy and say we're 2-3 weeks behind them. And people in Greece can look at Italy and say we're 3 weeks behind them. And Russia can say we're 4 weeks behind Italy. So everyone kind of sees now what may be playing out in the future for, you know, their society and their community and their country. What does that tell you about the virus and what does that mean for the economics of things? I mean, China's going to start ramping up, but everyone else is going to be kind of, you know, in the thick of it.
I'm one of those people who does say that China, you know, botched it at the beginning. I think for 2 months, it took them about 2 months to understand what was going on in Wuhan and Hubei province. Having said that, we have to acknowledge that after those 2 months, they acted with a vengeance. I mean, they did gain control of the situation. Why were they able to do that? Because China, though it has been the great beneficiary of globalization, actually has an extremely strong state. It has very strong borders. It controls its borders very toughly. It controls its markets very toughly. It doesn't have a fully convertible currency. And of course, within China, the Chinese state can do things that few other states have the power to do. It could create, build hospitals almost at will. It can lock down whole cities. It could control population movements. It can do all sorts of things. I mention all of this because, of course, China comes back to that point that we were saying just now about how sovereign states have been weakened, and this has weakened their response, both to the financial and the economic problems and to the health problems. Because China was so strong, is so strong, it remains a strong sovereign country. It has been able to, in effect, get to grips with this situation more quickly, I think, than many people thought it would. And if you look at Russia, Russia has also got strong state. It has essentially closed its borders. It closed its borders to China. It's closed its borders to Europe. It closed its borders to Italy very quickly. It's got a massive testing program. It isolates people. It both imposes enormous fines on anybody who doesn't self-quarantine after they've been registered as, you know, being infected. A Russian MP who turned up to parliament even after he'd visited Italy and didn't report the fact is now apparently in serious trouble. There's again an example of a strong government taking charge. You see, the trouble is in Italy, as I understand it, things are not that well organized as they were in China, and they're not as well organized perhaps as they would be. The important thing to say, however, is, as you said, these epidemics do apparently follow a kind of bell curve. It's probably that Italy, I don't know whether it is at the peak, but it's heading towards it, and it will climb down. And as you rightly say, other countries are following behind Italy. How quickly they organize themselves and prepare for the fact that the epidemic is going to hit them, that is the unanswered question. And I get the impression that in Germany, the government is asleep at the wheel. I have to say this, I get the same sense in Britain. And of course, in France, Macron isn't really responding to this in any sort of intelligent way. So we are going to see all kinds of problems in all sorts of places because they're not really responding to this as toughly and as strongly as China did and as China showed you could do. Now, you know, I remain of the view that come the summer, we will have been through the worst. I mean, that seems to me how these epidemics work. And then, as you said, China's economic activity is rebounding. And I think the rest of the world would rebound also. But if we're going back to the economics of this, China is rebounding. But of course, it can't export because its customers' demand has dried up there. It can't sell to the US. It can't sell to Europe because it's going to be the turn of those economies now to go into lockdown. And I read an interesting article in Global Times, which is the, you know, major English language Chinese newspaper, acknowledging that for China, this is going to be a serious problem, and talking about how they need to try and boost domestic demand to absorb the products of all of those Chinese factories, which would otherwise have been exported. So China may have overcome the coronavirus within its own country to a great extent, but it still faces the economic problems that come in the coronavirus's wake.
Okay, let's turn to the United States, Canada, also Brazil. Bolsonaro said there were rumors that he tested positive, and then he came out on Twitter and said that he has tested negative. That was interesting, but obviously Brazil is a huge country, and the virus has reached Brazil as well. So, I mean, it's everywhere. You had the press conference of Trudeau. You also had Trump giving his Oval Office speech. What did you make of those two speeches, Alexander, those two press conferences? One was a press conference, the other one was an Oval Office speech. How do you think both leaders handled them individually?
Well, let's go to Donald Trump and the Oval Office speech, because I'm afraid, I mean, I said I thought he might turn out to be a good crisis manager. At the moment, he's turning out to be a terrible crisis manager. I mean, there's still time. He can still learn, and we'll see what he does once he does declare a state of emergency. But I thought that speech was very disappointing, not because of the flight ban from Europe, which, by the way, I think was a perfectly appropriate response. I mean, as I said, you do need to control movements. But he didn't match that control with the kind of action within the United States, which I think is needed. And I agree with those people who say what he needed to do was to say that the United States will be moving forward towards a major testing program. And if there are problems with that and logistical problems, which I think there are, I mean, unquestionably there are, and they're probably not his fault. Not, he needs to be, you know, straightforward about that and transparent about it, but also give people the reassurance that those problems, those logistical problems, are being dealt with. He needed to come across as the commander-in-chief, giving, you know, positive statements about what sort of things the US government was prepared to do and would do, and reassure them that it is confident in its actions and will protect them. You know, cliches and bromides about, you know, what a great country the United States is and how it can and will defeat the coronavirus, I mean, they may be true. I've no doubt they are true, but they are not what people want to hear and need to hear at this time. And, you know, I have to say, I was listening to Trudeau. I didn't think he was very much more impressive either. I mean, he's apparently, you know, running the country essentially from home now. I didn't feel that Canada is any more on top of the situation than the United States is, even though it has arguably a more integrated health system than the United States does, and ought to, in theory, be in a better position to respond to this thing. So I don't think the North Americans came across very well. And as for Brazil, I mean, it doesn't help when we have contradictory messages coming out of whether the president is got the coronavirus or not. I mean, I assume he doesn't. But, you know, they should have knocked on that one much more quickly. And again, I don't really know. I mean, in some ways, less important whether or not Bolsonaro himself is infected. And we need to have a clearer picture of what Brazil, this immense country, is going to do. Now, you know, I'm sorry, I'm going to come back to Russia. I mean, I've already said some of the things that the Russians are doing. Putin has had three meetings about the coronavirus already. And, you know, they've all been, we've got videos of them. They've appeared, there's discussions on his, on the Kremlin's website. once again, he does give the impression of being in charge. And he's spoken with his National Security Council. He's spoken with his health advisors. There's apparently a very carefully prepared plan to respond to this, which is clearly heavily influenced by what the Chinese did. And that's what you want to see. I don't, you know, want to constantly give the impression that, you know, the Russians are better at this than other people are. But it does seem to be generally to be the case up to now in this case. And if Russia does have fewer cases than other people, it's because they took the steps right at the beginning to control their borders.
Well, they're able to do those things. I mean, you know, they can act in more of an authoritative kind of
yes. And so
way.
It must
it's, be. And in, so in the US, it'll be a lot more difficult for them.
It would be more difficult, but at least Trump is belatedly starting to take action to control the borders. The disaster is the European Union. By the way, not all European countries. I mean, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, a lot of these Eastern European countries, which have very different attitudes and views about sovereignty, are taking steps to control their borders. So is Austria. They're basically telling the Germans and the French, you know, Merkel and Macron, to go hang. And so they should. I mean, you can't let these dogmas about free movement interfere with a public health emergency.
Watching Trudeau, and actually I'll even throw Boris Johnson in there, and watching the way they delivered their coronavirus speech to their citizens, and watching Trump at the Oval Office, one thought came to me. Trudeau should be in a scenario, and Boris Johnson should be in a scenario where Trump is. I'm saying the PR and the media optics, in other words, sitting behind a desk and speaking, and Trump should be in the media optics where Johnson and Trudeau were, talking to the press or, you know, getting feedback, you know, back and forth from people. I think Trump excels in a format, you know, where Boris Johnson and Trudeau was, and Trudeau and Boris Johnson probably would excel in just a teleprompter and looking at the camera and just speaking. Trump just looked way, way out of his element. He is not made for an Oval Office type of, you know, speech like a Reagan or even an Obama, Bush, the way they would just sit in the Oval Office and just read the teleprompter and just, you know, be totally scripted. That's not Trump. And that's why it made Trump very, very indecisive and uncertain.
That is so true. I mean, Trump thrives with interaction. I mean, he should have definitely gone for a press conference. I mean, that is his natural medium. He should have had a press conference, perhaps even call them into the Oval Office if that's what, you know, or do it in the Rose Garden or somewhere like that. He should have had the Surgeon General with him. He should have had the people from Homeland Security. He should have been there to answer the questions of the media, to give his usual take on things. He's very good at that. And, you know, to bring in all the other people, you know, and to appear to give the orders right away and to give the sense that he's part of this team. That's the kind of thing that Trump thrives in. I don't know who it was who gave him the idea to give this address from the Oval Office. And I don't know who wrote that speech.
It was just stiff. The whole thing was stiff and it lacked confidence.
Yeah, it didn't come. It didn't come over well. You know, both of us have worked with television. We both had to speak directly into cameras. And we know what an artificial thing it is, because you don't see things. You don't interact with people. And some people are good at it. Like Ronald Reagan was superb at it, because, of course, as he'd been trained when he was, you know, when he'd been acting in Hollywood, to actually work with the camera. And he knew how to use the camera. I mean, for me, the single greatest Oval Office address I've ever heard was the one that he gave after the Challenger accident, which was just marvelous. And it was exactly what was needed at that situation. But, you know, that isn't Trump. And I think Trump is made very uneasy when instead of talking to people, he's talking to a camera and a microphone. That isn't him at all. And he isn't somebody either who really works well from scripts.
Yeah, the talent.
He does. That's not him. I mean, he's a spontaneous sort of person. He needs the interaction and the feel of the crowd, even if the crowd is journalists. And as I say, you bring all these people in. That's where he thrives. As for Johnson and Trudeau, well, I mean, as you correctly say, they looked completely out of their depth. Frankly, I think they would have looked, certainly Johnson, would have looked as bad speaking from the House of Commons. I think Trudeau also, actually, from Downing Street or from whatever the Canadian Prime Minister's residence is. I don't think they come across well in that kind of situation, whatever the format. I think Trump, in a press conference, might have come across well.
I think it would have shined in a press conference.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot more in command. Well,
I hope he learns from that, actually.
It was a PR mistake.
It's a huge PR mistake, and as it did him harm. I hope he learns from that, because, irrespective of what, you want, he needs to succeed for the benefit of the US in this situation, because he is the president.
I hope he doesn't regret that PR decision and that media decision, because in much the same way that the Bush-Katrina crisis can define a presidency where, Bush was flying over Katrina and they snapped that photo of Bush looking out the window at the devastation below Air Force One. Many times these media and PR decisions can have a lasting effect on a presidency. And I hope that picture of Trump at the Oval Office and the stiffness and the uncertainty doesn't come back to haunt him.
I'm going to say this. I mean, Trump is very good at bouncing back. That seems to be when he's on the defensive, he somehow brings him back. He sort of gets energized by it, and he finds the way to come back. And if he does that, people will forget about it. I mean, the problem with Bush, in Air Force One, hovering over New Orleans with all those people there. I mean, he looked impossibly remote, and he didn't do anything to change that. Trump has the time and the space to change that, but he needs to understand that he's got to do this. And I think he's certainly got to resist some of the suggestions that are floating around about holding what will be, in effect, an electronic election campaign, which I think would be a disaster. Certainly a disaster for him. He needs to be out there looking like he's in charge with his officials and his ministers around him, talking to the media, talking to the American people through the media, and so in the way that he does, active, visible, and vital as he can be.
Yeah, I agree with that. He needed to sit. He needed to have interaction with the press, even have the press criticize him, because that's where he's at. Where he's at his best is when they're actually going after him. And he needed to say, "Look, everybody, this is serious. This is a big deal. But we're the United States of America. We are going to test everybody. We're going to ramp up testing." And he needed to say, "We are going to find a vaccine or a cure, because we're the United States of America and I'm president of the US and we're going to make it happen. And if people said it won't happen, it won't happen." Trump should have said, "Watch, I'm going to make it happen." That's what he needed to do. Trump needed to show that kind of leadership.
Absolutely. That's exactly what he needed.
And he couldn't express it in the Oval Office. He couldn't get it out.
No, I agree. Totally.
And Trudeau couldn't get it out. I was watching Trudeau and Johnson. And Trudeau, I thought, was the best of the three.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually.
Trudeau couldn't.
Grudgingly,
but he couldn't.
I agree.
He was there, and he wanted to ramp up his voice, and he wanted to get out, we're gonna get through this. But he just couldn't get out the emotion to say, "Look, my wife tested positive, but don't worry. I'm in command. I'm in charge. This is what we're going to do. We're gonna get through this." He couldn't muster the leadership to get it out.
No. I agree. And I have to say, Johnson looks asleep at the wheel also. I mean, I don't think he really understands how to respond to this thing. And of course, we've had this extraordinary budget that was published, that the British government produced a few days ago. And it's already looking as if it belongs to another world, because it was clearly all done before the coronavirus appeared. And that's what the government needs to be prioritizing.
All right, we'll wrap it up. There's a long video. We'll wrap it up. We had a lot to discuss. Guys, subscribe to the channel. Donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, Subscribestar. You really help out when you donate. Check your subscription because YouTube's unsubscribing. And please go to the Durant shop. Pick up some merchandise.
Indeed so. Pick up lots of merchandise. And we also have this thing to show you, which is not our product, by the way, but it's the Patriot Beacon. Alex will tell you how to get it. It is the most amazing torch I have ever owned. It is the kind of torch that is perfect in a crisis, an emergency like this. It's the kind of torch you want to have in your car. And I'm a great driver, by the way. I love driving in all sorts of places. If you get lost, there's a compass there. If it's dark and you want to know where you are, well, you can have all kinds of lights. It can flash. It can do all sorts of extraordinary things. It's got a powerful magnet that you can have. You can stick it anywhere in, with a metal surface in your car. If you're as it's solar powered, it doesn't run out. So if everything goes wrong, if all the lights go out, well, all you need to do is put it in sunlight. So you're never going to be without power. And of course, that's useful because if you need to recharge your iPhone or your iPad, you can do it because it's got a USB port there. And of course, if you get trapped in your car, which heaven forbid, well, you can smash the windscreen. And there's also a very necessary windscreen, for your safety belt. You can cut the safety belt. It's an awesome thing. And of course, if we ever get into a Mad Max situation scenario, don't for a moment believe, well, it's perhaps the best possible thing you could have in that kind of world. I also use it for something else. I don't just have it in my car. I also have it when I'm walking my dogs. And if I put on the alarm, well, they tend to come, but they're actually being walked by my wife at the moment. So they're not within hearing distance. But it is an absolutely amazing torch. It's indestructible. It's got every accessory you can use. It's light, it's strong, it doesn't run out, and it's the best torch for these troubled times. We don't just have that torch, which we are promoting. We've also got our own wonderful products, like our magic mugs. This one has the symbol of Russia's elite special forces unit, the Alpha Force. So again, if anybody's in trouble, they're the kind of tough guys who can come to the rescue. That's what they do. They've done that many times. They've done it in Syria. They've done it in various hostage-taking situations, some of which have not been reported by the Western media, by the way. And these are great mugs. They are fantastically strong. They're light. They keep your tea hot. I've been drinking Russian caravan tea at the moment, by the way, for those who are interested. And if you put them in the microwave, which you should never do because it's the best way to ruin good tea or coffee, well, the handle remains cold. I've tested this several times and it works. It's amazing. And we don't just have our mugs. We have our shirts, long-sleeved, short-sleeved T-shirts. I've got a long-sleeved T-shirt now, all of them with the Durant logo there. We have the most amazingly stylish and remarkable polo shirts. We've got V-neck shirts. We've got hats, hoodies, and stickers. We've also got amazing ebooks covering subjects like Russiagate and Ukrainegate and Brexit and Epstein. We mustn't forget those, even in these darkening times, because they are still part of that great general picture of the world we live in. So you can find all these things in our shop. You can be the owner of these great things, and you can support the Durant at the same time. And of course, you can be safe if you buy yourself a Patriot Beacon. So come to our shop, come to the Durant, support the Durant. Alex will tell you how to do it.
And also support our friends at the Patriotic Legacy with the Patriot Beacon flashlight. It's awesome. There's a 20% discount for everyone in the Durant community. 20% when you use the code Durant20. I will have all the information in the description box down below, a link to the to the Beacon and the code as well, Durant20, and of course the durantshop.com. Please help us out and purchase some merchandise. Alexander Mercuris, thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.